You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Paul Lynch, Irish novelist and author of the 2023 Booker Prize-winning novel, Prophet Song. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
We narrate the story of our lives to ourselves. We narrate it in linear fashion. And I know many writers have played with time in all sorts of amazing ways, but we're storytellers. This is what we do. And if you give the brain a story, a pre-packaged story, you're giving a cheesecake. That's what it wants. That's why it loves stories. That's why our society is just built on stories. Politics is nothing but stories. Everything we do in the evenings, we sit down, we're watching Netflix, just stories. We consume them all the time. We're just machines for belief. The kind of fiction that I was pushing is a tradition that's maybe not recognized all that much. And I wrote an essay about this last year, and I call it cosmic fiction. When I say cosmic, I'm referring to writers such as Melville, Dostoevsky, Conrad, Faulkner, many others, but writers who are really crafting fiction as though it's a cosmic eye in the sky, as though looking from a great distance, what we are as human beings always, what is the human condition? But at the same time, it's fiction that has the ability to get down to the furniture in the room, to describe the texture of the wood on the table, to describe human beings in extraordinary detail, and to have that sense of scalability, to have that sense of the absolute within reach always, that sense of the cosmos, that sense of the human condition, of our alienation, of our position in this vast universe, while at the same time, you know, the heat of life and the wants and desires and needs and the foolish aspirations and the emotions that tangle us up and all of these things, and to get them down into the one place. And so this kind of fiction always has within reach a sense of the infinite. And I think it is a tradition. I don't think it's been articulated properly by anybody, but I'm trying to articulate it. I think it's something very specific.
I'm fascinated by how the Irish have made English their own through this Hiberno-English, also known as Irish English.
There is very definitely an extraordinary richness to the language. And one of the reasons for that is that the country spoke Irish largely before it spoke English. And so grammatically, the structure of Irish is different to English. And so what happened was, as Ireland adopted the English language, this sort of hybridization started to occur where the language was placed on top of Irish grammatical constructions. So you get this slipperiness, this ability to place sentences, to move them around, to place words in interesting places, and to use different constructions that you just wouldn't find in England. I'll give you an interesting example. This is some years ago. I was walking along the road where I live, and I heard two people talking, two local working class people. And this fella's walking up, and he stopped by this younger lady, and she says to him, "Were you lashing the sunbeds out of it? Were you lashing the sunbeds out of it?"
Okay.
By which she means, have you been using the sunbeds too much? The thing about being an Irish writer is there is an irreverence. There is sort of a sense of implicit freedom that we can use the language whichever way we like. So long as you have mastery and command of the language, you can push it to the edges. And we've got writers who've done that, of course. I mean, Joyce would be the end point of that. A writer like Joyce is a writer of the scale of Shakespeare. And so a writer at that level transmits energy into the culture, and they change the language. Yeah. And they transmit just this sense of freedom to try things that I would hazard that English writers, for example, just might not feel as free to do so. They might feel a greater responsibility with the language. But Irish writers, I mean, we just take brazen risks. But the risks that I see are always in pursuit of truth. And the project, as I see it, is always to try and seize hold of reality in some way. And reality isn't just what you see. It can be internal. It can be dream. It can be the full depths of human experience, which can include the Gnostic. And so you have to push language into spaces and places, and you have to bend it and you have to break it to articulate or get across the feelings of things that otherwise might be beyond description. In terms of the cosmic and the personal, it always begins with, for me, a personal problem. It always begins somebody located in space and time with real human problems, somebody who's seeking after something that just some problem that needs to be resolved. It's not just a simple problem. It's something that I've been mulling over probably for years. It's something that's going to take me into more of something probably very metaphysical, something very considerable. The novel needs to be its own answer. And built into that will be the sense of the cosmic, the sense of the problem of time, of being a human being. And so we're always surrounded by moments of time that remind us that our time is passing. My novels are full of these glimpses from all sorts of different places. They may come from the land or from people or from memory, but they're glimpses of the fragility of life, the shortness of time, you know, what the Japanese call mono no aware, that passing moment. Well, in the novel, what's unfolding is inescapable. And that's a very important quality to try and locate within the reader themselves, this feeling that what's unfolding is inevitable. It's like a riptide that's pulling you out to sea. And it's something that Eilish is going to fight against, she's going to struggle against. But it's the feeling of the time that you're in. Rather, you know, as I mentioned earlier, rather than writing in the past tense, just an event that's already happened. And this is a story that's been told in the now. It's a story that's designed to create the feeling of imprisonment in the moment as it happens. And so Eilish is waking up to a world where what she took for granted all her life, the known world of life in a liberal democracy. So, you know, there is that sense of life as you knew it, life in a liberal democracy that you believe is going to continue always, actually may not continue always, that actually you're watching the unraveling of it. But it's the recognition of the unraveling. It's very hard to do. We even have it in our own moment now. There's definitely an unraveling occurring. But how many of us are able to recognize it? And worse, what are we able to do about it? So that sense of powerlessness that one feels, that sense of being alienated from the moment that you're in, that sense of being caught up in an unknowing, this is part of why the proper song is structured the way it is, that you're locked into these block paragraphs. There's no room to breathe. There's no white space, because what Eilish is experiencing is claustrophobic. Unfortunately, it seems to be that this particular energy is not new. It's a timeless energy. I think it's a very dangerous thing to narrow fascism down to something that belongs to the 20th century, or even to say that it's a modern phenomenon. I think that fascism is a very ancient phenomenon that is just dressed in the clothes of the 20th century. I think what we're talking about here are evolutionary drives that are built into us. Tribalism is an instinct. And I think that when human beings have a sense of serious scarcity or threat, they default to behaviors that are unthinkable. And it lies in the shadow within all of us, unfortunately. And the particular moment that we're in seems to have something unique in that technology is fueling this to an extraordinary extent. It's tapping into the particular weaknesses that we have as people, you know, our fears, our anxieties, it's stoking outrage, it's stoking anger, it's driving these forces. And unfortunately, it's very obvious that there are malign actors behind this who are willingly trying to undermine our democracies. And so it's happening at an extraordinary speed. My sense is throughout history, when you look at these particular energies unfolding, it usually leads to a catharsis of some kind, doesn't it? And catharsis is war. So how do we define ourselves? How do we endure all of these ancient problems that go back to the Greeks? I'm trying to put modern flesh on them, you know, these metaphysical problems of what does it mean to be a human being? How much human being is in a human being? And how do we arrive at a sense of dignity as people, especially when we're being met with the unwanted, the unknown, when we're being met with the worst, when we're being met with the absolute threat to our lives? How do we define ourselves in a world that doesn't want to know us? I have no faith. I belong to a generation that's come out of what could be described as theocratic Ireland. You know, the Catholic Church had an incredibly strong grip, a vice-like grip on this country, and it was insufferable. And the grip was to such an extent that, you know, Freud once joked that the Irish are the only nation impervious to psychoanalysis. And I often wondered what he meant until I realized, well, you go to psychoanalysis to have whatever shame you're grappling with internally, to have it taken out of you. But you can't have the shame taken out of you if the shame is actually structural, if it's what society is built out of. And that's what the church did to Ireland. So I belong to what you might call post-Catholic Ireland now. But the question of the spiritual is very interesting. I have no faith, but I view the word spiritual in a very different kind of way. I don't view it in a religious sense, but I do think that there's a very important aspect of self to be recognized, which is our place within the cosmos, within the world that we're in. Not everything is political, unfortunately, though we live in a time where our society believes that everything can be solved by and within society. And this is a really dangerous thought because it's just not true. And when Robinson Crusoe washed up on that desert island and found himself confronting himself within the empty world that he was in, he was confronting himself, his God and his cosmos. And that's a very private conversation that everybody needs to have. And so our relationship to life, our relationship to the moment that we're in, our relationship to the unfolding moment are all very important things. These things have always been religious ideas, but they're also not religious ideas. You know, you can call them spiritual if you like. They're a huge part of my writing. I think that locating the reader in the moment of unfolding is something that I try to do. I write in the present tense. I'm very interested in the texture of life, the feeling of life, the heartbeat of life, and also at the same time, the alienation that one feels every moment in life, the unknowing, the sense of being up against the what next. You know, when you write in the past tense, which is the default mode of fiction, something has been lost that I think is found when you write in the present tense. And obviously, I think the present tense is something that borrowed heavily from cinema, but Dickens did it. There are other writers wrote in the present tense before the domination of film. But something within the present tense that I love very much is how you can create that feeling of the unknown, of our alienation right in this very moment of just not knowing that life is darkness. Life is what Virginia Woolf called that small flame in the dark. We move through life step by step with just this small matchlight casting this small bit of light. And the rest is unknowing. That's how it is. And so that's a very metaphysical thing. And so for my sentences, you know, whether you want to call it metaphysical or spiritual or whatever, there is that sense of pushing into the moment, pushing into the known, but also pushing into the unknown, taking the reader right up to the edge of that, because the character lives on the edge of that. And when you do that, you take the reader into that moment with the character. So the reader begins to feel entirely alongside that character, entirely in step with that character. There's a quote from Ingmar Bergman, the great film director, that's very, very important to me, because he articulates precisely what it is you're supposed to do as a writer. He says that intuition is the spear you throw into the dark. Intellect is the army you send in afterwards. And so writing has to come from the place of intuition. It has to come from the place of authenticity. You know, I'm a big believer in what the Greeks called the daemonic. That sense of the Greeks believed that creativity was not something within you, it was external to you, that when you were creative, your personal daemon was in communication with the gods. That was the channel through which inspiration came. But of course, we know that's an internal process. And your daemonic is something that when you enter into deepest flow, you move past the intellect, you move entirely into the intuitive sphere, and you're writing from a place that's not intellectual. You're writing from a place that is, you know, it's hard to describe this. I'm a meditator, but it's a higher mind. It's a higher level of consciousness. It's a sense of self that sits outside time. It's a sense of self that has a fuller sense of what it is it wants to express or explore. And I write from this place. And for me, research only comes in later. Research is something that I do to add physics to the universe that I'm writing. For me, writing begins first and foremost with problems of the spirit, problems of the person, problems of being alive, of being in the world. And I move forward from that place. It's always intuitive. There's always some kind of problem that I need to resolve. I bring the intellect in afterwards. I mean, I always know exactly what I'm doing. I know the ideas I'm chasing, the ideas that are under the line, so to speak. But the fundamental driver is the intuitive self. And so it's really important not to intellectualize your writing. It's really important not to overthink it, not to, you know, subject it to academic thought, because you're just going to hobble yourself. It has to come from the other side, the dark side of your mind. It has to come from the place of unthought. And meditation is one of the great ways to get to that place, or any kind of practice that gets you up into that space where flow or the demonic can be accessed. I ended up being the chief film critic for the Sunday Tribune in Dublin, which is a newspaper that doesn't exist anymore, but it was a very serious broadsheet center-left paper. And so it was a really cool thing to do. And I reviewed over 1,000 films in that time, and many of them essay length. And I suppose I learned something very fundamental, which is that even the most fractured art house film is still fundamentally telling a story. The story is inescapable. It really is fundamental to what we are as human beings. And I think this is backed up by modern neuroscience. You know, when you think about how we view the world, there's data around us all the time. And we see A and we see C and we infer B. We're constantly narrating reality to ourselves. We narrate the story of our lives to ourselves. We narrate it in linear fashion. And I know many writers have played with time in all sorts of amazing ways, but we're storytellers. This is what we do. And if you give the brain a story, a pre-packaged story, you're giving it cheesecake. That's what it wants. That's why it loves stories. That's why our society is just built on stories. Politics is nothing but stories. Everything we do in the evenings, we sit down, we're watching Netflix, just stories. We consume them all the time. We're just belief machines for belief. AI in itself at this moment in time is not all evil. It does some very interesting, useful things. But I deeply disagree with, I actually not just disagree, I abhor the fact that thousands of writers have had their work just fed into the machine without their permission. I think it's outrageous. It's a disgrace to feed the learning capacities of AI. But, you know, do I fear for storytelling? I don't think so, because I spoke about the daemonic earlier on, which is the authentic self, the daemonic, comes from a lived life. It comes from the pain of experience. It comes from all that truly makes up a person. And AI can seek to manipulate it, but there's something just incredibly unique in the way words are expressed by a human being, with all the imprint of a life in the choice of words, the imprint of a life in the sentences, that expression of feeling that comes from the authentic self, that sense of somebody who's lived in the world, who understands suffering or pain or whatever it is that makes a person. And when you transmit that into the words, and when you're somebody who's a genuine artist, a genuine voice on the page, it's incredibly unique and it's incredibly difficult to recreate artificially. And so for sure, AI is going to get to a point where it's probably going to script your low-rent Hollywood thrillers for us. And it might do well better than what we've been getting for the last 20 years, frankly. But in terms of art, I'm not that worried. Art, I think, will endure.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.